My name is Rebecca. I am 14 years old, and today I had ice cream.
My name is Kimberly. I'm 12 years old, and today I ate a Starburst.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and don't be fooled by the youthful voices of Seattle sisters Rebecca and Kimberly Young, or their sweet teeth. These are a couple of very smart, highly motivated young women. And that first became clear to the world a couple years ago.
It was the summer before my fifth grade, and we were just looking for kind of a family project to do together that summer.
We were going to do a chicken coop in our backyard.
But instead we decided on, you know, launching a weather balloon.
So I think a lot of people have seen those online, but can you just explain for somebody who's never seen or encountered this project before, what is the weather balloon project?
So a weather balloon is essentially a very large helium balloon that is sent up with different instruments to collect data about weather and other things.
How high do they go?
Our first one went to 78,000 feet, and I think the highest went to 101,000 feet.
Ours went into the stratosphere, which is the sort of the second layer of the atmosphere.
It didn't go all the way to space. For reference, it's about the first launch went to about 2.5 times the height of Mount Everest.
What were the instruments that you sent up?
So we had an Eagle flight computer, which we ordered online from a weather ballooning website, but it tracked things like temperature, pressure, altitude, speed, direction.
And did you have a camera as well?
Yeah, we had two cameras, which was really one of my favorite parts of the project because we just have these really beautiful pictures from up there.
What does it look like?
Well, most of the images that we have, you can just start to see the curvature of the Earth, and there's a little blue ring of the atmosphere on top of that. And the entire top half of the picture is just black, empty space, and it's really, really cool to see.
So even though you're not in space, it sort of feels that way. It feels like you're above the Earth's atmosphere and into the blackness.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Did you think anyone was going to care that you did this?
Not at the time, no. It was just our family thing. To us, it felt pretty similar to finishing a Lego kit. And it had really never occurred to me then that other people would find it so interesting.
They did find it interesting. By the girls' third launch, they were getting covered in newspapers and magazines and national network television.
A lot of people are excited because the solar eclipse is on Monday and it has scientists across the country excited. And two of the most excited may be these two sisters from Seattle, 10-year-old Kimberly and 12-year-old Rebecca. They're going to send up their homemade launcher during the eclipse.
They got to tour NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they received another very special invite.
We got nominated to go to the White House Science Fair, where we presented our project for the former President Barack Obama. And we just had a conversation about our project. It was really amazing.
He really understood what we were talking about and really understood and asked pretty in-depth questions that we just hadn't heard before.
I can imagine this is kind of a defining moment of your childhood, right? That's a big deal to get that much attention, to go and meet the President of the United States and so on. So were you thinking about how to follow up on that or what your second act was going to be?
We thought a lot about energy production, actually, sustainable energy, but we didn't really end up following through on that summer. What we really started to think about was an issue that we cared more about was homelessness. And that led us to the Tinley House.
Specifically, that led them to an office, the Low Income Housing Institute in Seattle at 2407 First Avenue, Suite 200. Who cares about the address? Well, it happens that today on Sound Effect, we're marking our 200th episode. So every story today is one we found through a connection with a Suite 200. That office is where Rebecca and Kimberly's next project took shape.
We found video about Lehigh, the low-income housing institute, and they create tiny houses where it's 8 by 10 feet, about the size of a small bedroom, where homeless people can live and have temporary housing until they can find something more stable.
And what made you care about this issue?
Well, I do martial arts in the international district, It's called Wushu, and every time I drive there, we pass by a lot of tents and homeless people on the sides of the streets, and we just really wanted to do something to help solve that problem.
Yeah, say more. I mean, a lot of people pass these tent communities, and it's a very visible thing, but not everybody does something about it.
I think you're right that a lot of people do pass these, and I think a lot of people want to make change, but aren't quite sure how they can, because homelessness, especially in Seattle, we know is such a big problem, and it can seem insurmountable. We knew we wouldn't be able to just start something that would fix the entire problem, but by physically building a tiny house, we have the capability to take at least one person off the streets.
Yeah. So how did it begin? How did you start the project?
It took two forklifts of two pallets of stuff that arrived in our driveway, and it was a lot of materials. And we just started by looking at the instructions and sort of trying to figure out and sort all the different things into what steps we would need.
Yeah, so there were instructions to kind of help us build, but for us who had never done any construction before, I guess we were expecting like IKEA instructions, like you nail this here. It wasn't like that. It was like, frame this wall. I don't think the instructions were all that comforting at first.
What do you need for something like this? I mean, like, can you just do it with a hammer and nails? Do you need some serious power tools? What do you need?
We used power tools a lot, mostly the miter saw and the circular saw to cut bigger things. But quite a lot of just the combining things was just a hammer and nails.
Yeah. She turned out to be better at hammering than me.
Do you agree with that, Kimberly?
Well, at the end.
I was frustrated by this. There was a little bit of jealousy there.
Was there anything that you guys weren't allowed to do that had to be an adult? Or were you guys basically allowed to touch all the parts of it?
We were allowed to touch everything once we'd learned how to do it. Our parents didn't just send us out, here's a saw, you've never used it before, go. We learned, and they watched us practice. And then after a while, once they knew we could do it, it was fine for us to just go and, you know, cut a piece of wood.
So how did it go? Were there parts of it that took longer than you expected, or easier, harder than you expected, more fun than you expected?
I think something that was really important for us is that we did it with a lot of our community. And it was just, you know, some friends from school or family friends or cousins came out. And there were definitely times when everyone was building together. Like on big days, the first day we made the floor, we had a bunch of people over and everyone was working and everyone had a job. And I think those days were the most fun for me.
So how often when you were working on it, did you think about the larger purpose of it and think about the person that you hoped at some point that this would help?
Well, when we had first finally decided to do it, we took a visit to one of the tiny house villages, and we were guided by someone who worked at Lehigh. And actually being there and seeing other tiny houses and just seeing how the village worked and talking to people who lived there really, really grounded the experience for me and made it real. And I think I was skeptical about it before, but that was what really convinced me that we had to try.
Well, what do you remember most about that trip? What do you remember seeing, hearing, people you met, etc.?
I think the village was actually somewhere that we'd been around. We just hadn't really noticed the village before. And I think being there and seeing, you know, familiar buildings around us and just noticing that here was a place where everyone is trying to do better. Everyone's trying to get back on their feet, and seeing how much this house actually helps them with that. It's not something that I had considered before. But like they said, having a place to be able to lock your door and say, this is mine, can just give you the confidence to maybe apply for a job or look into more permanent housing, which I was really happy to be able to help with.
Yeah. How about you? Do you have any memories of that trip that stick with you?
There was a community where everybody helped each other. There was communal kitchen, and everybody shared everything with each other. And that was just really incredible to see how much everybody was trying to get back.
What do you remember feeling when it was done?
I remember we posed for a picture in front of it before the forklift came to take it away again. And I just remember thinking, I was very proud of what we'd done, but it was also a little bit bittersweet because this thing had been in our driveway for 2 months and now it was leaving. And it was kind of like, there was kind of a piece of us in it, just a piece of our accomplishment. And I remember, I felt kind of weird that I wasn't sure what quite to call it at the time.
It was a little bit sad to see it go away. I was the only one home when the delivery guy came. But it was mostly just happiness that I knew that we were helping somebody and that our project would benefit others.
So what has become of the house?
So it's in the Love, L-U-V, Lake Union Village, tiny house village. And it's there. There are people living in it. And as far as we know, it's been a success.
Have you ever thought about going to visit or meet the people?
We have thought about it. We actually really considered it. But in the end, I think
we decided against it.
We wanted to respect their privacy. And so we figured that it would be, I think that would benefit us more than it would benefit them. And we just wanted to respect them as much as possible.
You're like a more grown up than me in that respect, I think. So looking back on it now, what are your sort of biggest impressions? Like, what do you take away from it, from the experience of doing it?
Well, I think for me, remembering how scared I was of it at the beginning and then actually being able to complete it successfully. Like, we met all of our goals for the project. We made the house. We did it before school started. It works. It didn't fall apart. People are living in it. And we think about this a lot. It's in one of our lessons learned from the Loki Lego launcher that, you should just try something. You never know what's going to happen. But this was really, it put that in practice. And I think that really has stuck with me. There have been times where I'm not sure if I should take this risk, but sometimes if I think about the house, it was a pretty big risk to take, and we managed to do it.
Kimberly and Rebecca Young live in Seattle. You can see pictures of their tiny house at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Listening to Sound Effect, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and in celebration of our 200th episode today, our theme is Suite 200, where all the stories connect to a place with Suite 200 in their address. At 159 South Jackson Street, Suite 200 in Seattle, you'll find the front office for the Seattle Sounders. But before the Sounders were a Major League Soccer powerhouse, they were part of a minor league outfit called the USL. They were also in a different building back then, and one of the businesses down the hall from the Sounders office is where Christine O'Connell worked doing graphic design. As a result, Christine got to know some of the Sounders players, including now-retired Sounder defender Zach Scott. She and Zach became friends, and when Zach decided to retire at the end of the 2016 season, Christine wanted to do something special to celebrate his career, so she designed scarves in honor of Zach to sell at his last match. It's kind of a soccer tradition called the testimonial match. Well, the scarves sold out. Zach Scott had family friends at the time whose 10-year-old daughter was fighting brain cancer. So Zach donated the scarf money to Seattle Children's Hospital. Christine had a little girl of her own named Jane. She started following the story of this girl who was battling cancer, who she calls Awesome Avery, on her family's blog. It was inspiring.
And I remember reading that and thinking, you know, what she's sharing here is going to be a light in the darkness for somebody.
Christine was right about that. It's just that she had no idea that somebody would be her.
Now, I remember meeting or talking to Avery's mom at Zach's testimonial match, which was the very beginning of March 2017. And 2 weeks later, I was in Awesome Avery's mom's shoes. 2 weeks later. We went in and it was St. Patrick's Day. And we're the O'Connells. Keep in mind, we're the O'Connells. And this was our holiday. And we went in for, you know, a blood test and some x-rays. And I came home And Jane was sitting on the couch watching a show. That was her reward for getting through the blood draw. And a doctor called from our pediatrician's office. I don't even know who it was. And she said they found a mass in Jane's abdomen. And then the doctor started to cry. And she told us that they'd be waiting for us at Seattle Children's. And that's really how our journey started. They weren't sure what it was. They could see that it was on her kidney, that there was a tumor on her kidney. And they were really preparing us for kind of a worst case scenario. And so they said, we're going to go in, and if it's safe to remove, we will. And if it's not, we'll just take a biopsy to see what it is that we're dealing with. And a few days after we were admitted, which felt like a month, Jane went in for a 6.5-hour surgery, and we found out about 40 minutes in that they were going to be able to remove the tumor, which I don't know if you can express a relief so great that it hurt. I mean, when we got that news, because the idea that they would go in there and poke a hole in it, which is cancer cells can leave through that hole, to biopsy it and sew her back up with that evil inside. And they removed a tumor the size of a melon, if you can believe that, from a 3-year-old girl. And the fact that there was no outward signs of that, and it had totally mangled one of her kidneys, so she lost her kidney. And we already knew that it had spread to her lymph nodes and her lungs, both lungs. So it was stage 4 cancer. And she immediately began 16 rounds of radiation and 7 months of chemo. And just to give you a glimpse of what that was like, one of the chemo drugs that we have to give Jane, or that we had to give Jane, is known to cause damage to children's hearts. I mean, we are giving her a poison that they know causes damage to their hearts. And so my husband and I stood there and watched them inject this directly into the port in her chest. And then like a week later, they did an echocardiogram to see if there was any damage evident yet, and there wasn't. And they told us, that means we can give her more. And it's just sort of stunning that these are the non-choices that parents have to make. This is what you have to do to just hopefully save your child's life. But the toxicity of this treatment is felt by these children for the rest of their lives. It shortens their lives. 80% of children are cured of their cancer, but they only go out 5 years. So 80% of children are still living 5 years after diagnosis. If you move the goal line out 30 years to when Jane is 34, that number goes down to 65. So I'm like, is 34, is that old enough for your kids? You know, is that good number good enough? Is that long enough? And, you know, of course, the answer is hell no, it's not. But these are some of the realities that my eyes have been open up to. My worst fear was that we were just going to beat the hell out of Jane and lose her anyway. My husband's worst fear was that we were going to somehow extinguish a light in her, because she was just, we call her Sweet Jane, because she just has such this sweet outlook and says these, you know, adorable things like little girls do. And that was his fear. I honestly believed that those bald kids must get all the funding, right? I mean, when you look at the array of things that childhood diseases that need funding, well, cancer, the kids with cancer, they must get all the funding. And that couldn't be further from the truth, because over 60% of funding for adult cancer drugs comes from pharmaceutical companies. And they will invest millions and millions in the hopes that one of those products will eventually come to market to treat colon cancer or breast cancer or what have you. And because there are so many adults with these cancers, they stand to make billions with a B. So, I mean, I understand that. That's a numbers game. And they will never recoup the investment when it comes to childhood cancers, because there simply aren't enough kids. So they don't invest. So then we look to the government, but the National Cancer Institute, for all of the money that's allocated towards cancer research, less than 4% goes to childhood cancers. I wasn't the sharpest thinker at that time. You know, you're in a very much of a mental fog, but I'm like, what can I do? And I had already made, you know, I had success selling those scarves at Zach's Match. And then I had also in 2016 entered the contest that the Sounders have every year to design the season ticket holder scarf. I entered that and won. And so, you know, there's 30,000 of the scarf that I designed out there. And I'm like, I can design scarves. I can do this. And I had this idea come into my head. So I'm like, well, I need to do something for Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry is the goalkeeper for the Seattle Sounders. I remember reading that he was an artist in addition to being an amazing goalkeeper. So I wrote a letter and said, this is what I'm doing. And then one day I got an email from him saying, you know, I'm so sorry that your family's going through this. Of course I have to help. And attached was the best scarf I've ever seen. It was so perfect in every way. And it was Stefan with this outstretched hand and his glove. And then after that, it said, you shall not pass. And that's really when I knew that this project would take off. So I designed my little website. I got scarvesfightingcancer.com. And the rest is kind of history. We're on 3 years now that we've done this. And because of them raising sort of my profile and Stefan's, even, you know, going to greater lengths to celebrate Stefan's contributions, invaluable contributions, because I can't stress enough that it wouldn't have happened or really wouldn't have taken off the way that it has without his assistance and, you know, his time and talent. We're getting really close to $100,000 over 3 years. We're only 2 years in remission now. We're still very much under the cloud of a potential relapse. But to look to the people who are coming behind you and lend them a hand the way that someone lent you a hand, that's where I am right now. I feel like cancer did not define us, or does not define us. And we're now, I feel like we're in charge again.
Christine O'Connell lives with her family, including Sweet Jane, in Kirkland. Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect. We find a lot of different doorways into stories for this show. And for this, our 200th episode, we got to all our stories through very specific doors, ones marked Suite 200. Next up, we head to Bremerton.
We're in the Normdix Government Center.
And where specifically are we in the Normdix Government Building?
We are in Suite 200 of the Normdix Government Center.
Thank you.
Kurt Wiest is executive director of the Bremerton Housing Authority, which builds and maintains public housing projects. We're here to talk about one of those in particular.
Sinclair Park, which was one of the original 11 developments built by the Bremerton Housing Authority during the period of time 1940 to 1945.
Thank you.
This is a history story with three chapters. There's even a celebrity cameo coming up later. But first, chapter one, growth. As a benchmark, take Seattle. It grew by more than 20% over the last decade, making it the fastest growing big city in the country. Now, compare that to Bremerton in the 1940s.
In 1939, the population of Bremerton was about 13,000. By 1945, the population had grown dramatically to 85,000.
Imagine that, quintuple the population in just over 5 years. This was, of course, the period of World War II.
There's a naval shipyard here, and so they were very much involved in not only shipbuilding, but also ship repair.
All those workers needed places to stay.
We had chicken coops turned into dwellings and attics converted.
In record time, the Bremerton Housing Authority sprang to life and started building. And building. By 1943, the agency had stood up multiple developments, including Sinclair Park, 280 dwellings arrayed on a hilltop overlooking Sinclair Inlet. As the shipyard work ramped up, workers and their families flooded into Bremerton. Sinclair Park filled up almost immediately with men, women, and many, many kids.
The stories that I hear over and over again is what a fun place it was to live because you had plenty of kids to play with, get into mischief with, have adventures, and all the other kinds of things that go along with day-to-day life. You went to school with them, and everybody was kind of tied together by both work experiences, school experiences, and wartime experiences.
That tableau of a bustling neighborhood of prefab houses, thick with kids and wartime activity, that was repeated at West Park and View Ridge, at Sheridan Park and Anderson Cove. But there was one thing that made Sinclair Park different.
The distinguishing feature for Sinclair Park was it was a segregated property.
Chapter 2, Race.
The vast majority of the residents at Sinclair Park were non-Caucasian. And that was the way it was.
We asked, was it going to be integrated? And they assured us, oh yes, it's going to be integrated. Well, they brought busloads of people, our people, in here to work in the Navy Yard. And they put all of them up there.
That's Marie Greer from a collection of oral histories on Sinclair Park from the early 2000s. In those recordings, residents recall how this mostly black housing project lacked amenities.
We didn't have no street lights. We had no telephones. We had no buses. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get buses.
Earl Smith talked about how this was especially tough for all those kids.
And of course, we lived up there, you know, a segregated hill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the city didn't really bring anything to offer us either, like a little play field or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the city just ignored us. Mm-hmm. It was a sad affair for young people. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, residents began creating their own community institutions. Local chapters of the Elks Club and the USO sprang up. There were church services, a community center, and the neighborhood had its own radio station.
Bristol-Myers, the makers of Sal Hepatica, famous laxative, and Minute Rub, modern chest rub, brings you Duffy.
In spite of the racist policies that created a segregated development at Sinclair Park, residents like Audrey Miller said they quickly solidified into a genuine, close-knit community.
Out of all of it, I feel we all came out still very fortunate. And we came from different parts of the United States to better themselves.
That's right.
And probably had it not been for that, we may not be where we are now today.
Yeah.
We'd still be stuck in our hometowns or our areas from where we came from.
Right.
And it was a beginning.
Chapter 3, An Awakening. And here's where the celebrity cameo comes in. Among the crush of workers arriving in 1943 on a Trailways bus was a father and his two boys fresh in from the south side of Chicago. The older brother was a restless 11-year-old named Quincy Jones.
Well, what happened is we went out there and we wanted to be baby gangsters like Rue Bremerton. It was Bremerton, Washington.
Oh, so you wanted to.
That's him, the legendary performer, composer, and producer, telling Stephen Colbert on The Late Show about this crucial chapter in his life. It's a story that Kurt Wiest knows well, too.
The community center in Sinclair Park was a hub of activity, and apparently there were some pies in the kitchen.
And we heard there was some lemon meringue pie and ice cream coming outside. We knew everything.
That sounds like gangster That's work, right, my friend.
And he and his teenage friend snuck in and were going to help themselves to some pies that were there.
And then we went around individually and broke in all the offices, right?
Yeah.
We were gangsters, man.
It sounds like it.
And while they were in the building, he, whether he had ever noticed it or not, he saw a piano.
Mrs. Ayers, the supervisor's office, and there was a spinet piano over in the corner. And I went over and I closed the door, and something said, "Idiot, go back in that room and see that, check that piano out." And I didn't know human beings played instruments, you know. I really didn't. And so I went over to that piano slowly, and I touched it, and every cell in my body said, "This is what you're going to do the rest of your life."
He was immediately connected to that instrument, which was just probably just an old beat-up piano in this community center. But it literally, in that moment, it changed his life.
Within a couple of years, the war would be over. Jones and his family left Bremerton for Seattle, and a career filled with names like Miles Davis, Frank Sinatra, and Michael Jackson. Sinclair Park, never meant to be a permanent neighborhood, moved on too. The houses were lifted up and transported to new locations. Some would house married students at the University of Washington. Others would be barged up the Columbia River to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Kurt Wiest says Quincy Jones may be Sinclair Park's most notable resident, but he's just one out of tens of thousands who owe some part of their history to Bremerton's World War II housing projects.
For every person like Quincy Jones, there are many, many others who have distinguished themselves in perhaps quiet and simple ways. And we, as an agency, have provided some semblance of stability so that they can pursue whatever their talents might be. So we are so proud of what Quincy Jones has done, but I just believe that there are, you know, just a whole community of others that are equally distinguished in simpler ways.
Kurt Wiest runs the Bremerton Housing Authority. The city of Bremerton is in the process of a major downtown redevelopment called Quincy Square, named after the most famous kid ever to come out of Sinclair Park. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're celebrating our 200th episode, where all the stories originate from places that have Suite 200 in their address.
My name is Marguerite Martin, and I am in a studio somewhere in Southwest Portland.
That Portland recording studio does not have a Suite 200 address, but there's a reason Marguerite is there, which we'll get to in a minute. The Suite 200 address in this case is in Tacoma. It's the office of movetotacoma.com. That's a website that Marguerite created several years ago. To understand how it came about and Marguerite's very particular status in Tacoma, we have to go back to the mid-2000s.
I was married at the time with my ex-husband in downtown Tacoma, and we loved it. And I was like, yeah, this is where I want to be. And we loved living there, and it was time to buy a house, and we just couldn't afford it.
They bought a duplex in Spanaway. But then the marriage ended, and Marguerite moved back to Tacoma into a studio apartment.
The cheapest one I could find. It was $450 and had a view of the port.
Marguerite ended up getting into real estate. Her timing was not great. It was right before the mortgage crisis hit, walloping Tacoma especially hard. But that was also when she began to see how special this big little city really is.
We bottomed so much longer than everybody else. We had the highest rate of foreclosure in the state. Like, I think at one point, 68% of all of the housing stock in Pierce County was either bank-owned or short sale. So it was distressed.
Wow.
The whole city was going through a hard time. You know, budget crisis, city manager changeover, you know, like, restaurants closing, businesses closing. Like, people that I thought were rich were losing their houses. Everybody was in it together, it felt like. And a lot of the, like, really great connections that I made in my life and, like, good friendships, like, those came out of, like, sharing a cigarette outside the mix, like, talking about what was going on.
When did you begin to become kind of a booster of Tacoma?
I think it was right around 2014. And I had, you know, lots of realtor friends in different parts of the country and just hearing about what was happening in bigger cities. And especially from realtors in Seattle, just like finding out like what was going on with their clients, I felt so bad for them because they were like, oh yeah, our clients don't get home inspections. Yeah, the median home price is like $500,000 now. I was like, $500,000? I could not believe it. No, that's stupid. You should tell them to move to Tacoma. And we had this joke like, hashtag move to Tacoma. And then one day I was like, well, that could actually be like a useful website. Because I also, on the other side of it, I had clients who were relocating, you know, maybe to do their residency with MultiCare or with St. Joe's, or people who are relocating to the base at JBLM who are like, oh my God, I'm Googling Tacoma and I'm just finding all these people saying it's a horrible place and like I'm just going to get shot. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Like, no, that's not what it's like, you know. And I was like, but what else are they finding? Like, no one's really making anything to show them that it's not this way. And so that was the idea of Move to Tacoma.
So you launched the website and started to grow it, and then this thing, this part of your life and work, seems like it kind of took off.
Going into building the website and to conceiving of the website, like, we didn't have a real estate boom in Tacoma yet. And so the idea of creating a website that would attract buyers to absorb these houses, like, that seemed like genius. Like, that seemed like a really good idea, or at least a worthy endeavor. But by the time I launched it, like, it was the very beginning of the phenomenon of, like, Seattle buyers moving to Tacoma. And so it got a lot of attention, you know, and they were like, is this a trend? And, you know, I was like, of course it's a trend. Like, yeah. And then it really was.
As the Tacoma market's fortunes rose, Marguerite rode the wave. She started a podcast. She was a mainstay of civic life. She got into activism. It seemed like Marguerite knew everybody in town. She had evolved from being a promotion-minded realtor to one of Tacoma's most ardent and prominent boosters. And as she explained to me during our conversation, that notoriety came with some complications.
At first, it was really good. I got invited to be on committees or to go to events or to speak at events, and it felt really good. I think what was hard is my friends were my clients, and there was a business, and even beyond just my real estate clients, you know, also they were now like colleagues in various endeavors, and like I just felt like I also had a very public life, you know. Videos and podcasts, and, you know, I was very active on all the social medias and, you know, engaging in difficult conversations and talking at things. And like, I started to feel like I was becoming kind of a persona more than a real person.
Well, did you feel like you had kind of boxed yourself into this role and that there wasn't room for other parts of you?
Yeah, for sure, I had boxed myself into a role, and maybe there wasn't room for other parts of me, and I didn't even know what those other parts of me were anymore. And the summer of 2017 was a very terrible time for me, and it was the most successful I'd ever been. I won some awards, and I made a lot of money that summer, and, you know, I started smoking again. Like, and I would just like smoke cigarettes on my deck and cry. Like, I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me here, but like, it was a very hard time because like, there was no meaning left in anything. Like, it didn't feel like I was helping the world at all. And it didn't feel like things were going to get better. And I think a lot of people go through something like that in their lives. But for me, it was all, it was all tied together with work and community and friends and, you know, what was happening in the world. You know, I had not had, you know, an experience of myself without all of that in years. It feels good to be connected in community, but it's, I think, when you're kind of having like that shifting identity and everyone is reflecting through no fault of theirs, like I'd given them, served up this version of myself and it was being given back to me and it just didn't fit anymore. And I didn't know how to fix it.
So how did a solution, or at least, a next move begin to take shape?
I went on a trip in the summer and met with a friend who'd moved out of Tacoma the year before. And she was like, well, how are you doing? And I was like, I'm fine. Like, I'm not, you know, depressed. I'm just, you know, I'm just kind of stagnant. I don't have any goals. I'm not really excited about anything, but I'm okay. And she was like, you know, normal people, like when they're going through something like this, would like move to a new place. I was like, I can't move to anywhere. Like, I told everybody to move to Tacoma. I have to live here forever. And she was like, what? No, you don't. You need to unpack that. I was like, huh. And a few days later, I saw some old friends that I've known since I was a teenager. And I was telling them about what she'd said. And they were like, well, where else have you lived besides Tacoma? And I was like, well, I'm as an exchange student in high school. And they're like, no, but where have you moved where you didn't know if you would come back? I was like, nowhere. And I was like, is this a thing people are supposed to? This is a thing that normal people do, that like fully formed human beings, like they go on a journey. And they were like, yeah, dummy. And I was like, oh, my God. And I remember like flying home from that trip and just looking at like a map of the U.S. and being like, OK, so like, could I live in Alaska? Would I move to Chicago? And then I was like, but I love Tacoma. Like, Tacoma is where I'm a Northwesterner, you know? And I didn't really want to challenge myself to, like, hang with East Coast people and learn how to be more direct and all that. So I was like, I'll just move to Portland. I don't know anybody there.
What did you imagine would happen if you left Tacoma?
I thought people would get really mad at me. I'm thinking about that now and it feels really stupid because that mostly did not happen. What was interesting was I spent a few days like thinking about it, and I talked to a couple members of my family about it, and they were both really supportive. And then I just did it. And I remember saying to the friend that had suggested this, I was like, so like, how do I tell everybody what I did? Like, I should probably like do like a video or maybe a podcast episode. We could unpack it. And she was like, no. You're not the sort of person that explains to everybody else why you do everything anymore.
Except when we call you.
Well, yeah. Like, so that was the thing. I was like, I'm not. And she was like, no, why don't you just try being the kind of person that doesn't explain yourself? And I was like, oh my God, I can't even imagine. So when I moved here, like nothing happened, Gabe. Nobody really even noticed. And like 6 months later, I deleted my Facebook, my personal Facebook, my personal Instagram, my personal Twitter. Nobody really noticed that either. And I was like, you know, maybe I have built up all of this agony and all of this stress about something that, you know, isn't really that big of a deal.
Well, tell me about the experience of being in a new city, not just like on vacation, but actually having to like find all your local places and meet people and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, like being available to people on that level and then to go from that to like just having control of my time and being able to decide whether or not I wanted to talk to anybody at all during the day. Like that was, I can't overstate how weird that was. And nobody knowing where I was. I remember I would just like walk down the street and it was fall and I was just like, I felt like I was getting away with something. I'm like, I'm not supposed to be here. I can't believe like I can just be here in this weird place that I didn't know where anything was. Like coming from Tacoma where like, you know, like people would text me every day like, hey, I want to have a special occasion with my partner, or hey, I'm throwing a birthday party. Do you know of a venue that can hold 50 people that's not too expensive? Or like, you know, like being, I wanted to be a resource for people moving here and I don't know anything. Like, I don't even know where happy hour is. I mean, that was a shift.
So where are you at now?
I'm working again. I'm still, you know, connecting people from Move to Tacoma to agents. And so, like, if somebody reaches out on Move to Tacoma and says, hey, Marguerite, like, I need a real estate agent. I want to buy in, you know, South Tacoma. And then I'll connect them to a realtor. And then that realtor pays me a portion of their commission. And that's how I'm able to, like, live. So Move to Tacoma still takes care of me, which is, that's also very complicated. Right? Like, and so how do I stay connected to Tacoma but not stay enmeshed with Tacoma? And so I'm starting to work again, but I'm working very differently than before. And I'm trying to imagine, you know, what would working look like if I wasn't myself the product? I still don't have an answer, but I have enough space to kind of think about it.
So it sounds like a lot of what kind of complicated your move was just this feeling of loyalty and almost obligation to Tacoma. And I just wonder if you think you would have felt the same thing if it had been a different city that you had been living in.
I always have kind of joked that, like, you know, all Tacomans are a little codependent. Like, Tacoma really needs you. You know, there's a lot that it's a city that's still becoming something. And, you know, it does kind of feel like to leave is to leave the work, you know, to leave that shared like mission. You know, it's, for me, it felt that way. Like living there was more than just like living in a place. It was like being a part of something.
Marguerite Martin is the founder of MoveToTacoma.com, which is still active. She's living in Portland these days, but she's not ready to call that a permanent move. More of a sabbatical.
Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Special thanks this week to Artifacts Consulting, Inc. and the Black Historical Society of Kitsap County for their help with our story on Sinclair Park. Kari Plogue wrangles our ones and zeros. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. You can hear the other 199 episodes of Sound Effect when you subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the Mom and Pop podcast app of your choice. Yet another option, tell your smart speaker, play the podcast Sound Effect. And if you want to wish us a happy fifth birthday, you can leave us a rating and review. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. You can find me on Twitter @GabrielSpitzer or follow our page on Facebook. Come on back next week when our theme is New Year, New Me. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.